BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. I'm joined by an amazing team of female detectives to investigate some infamous female criminals from the past. We're travelling back in time and around the world to Britain, Australia and America to look at the misdeeds of murderesses from the 19th and 20th centuries. What can their crimes and the times in which they lived teach us about women's lives today? This episode contains material you might well find distressing. It's 1892, and it's a cold January afternoon in Memphis, Tennessee. Passengers are picking their way across the mud and ice on the quay to board a Mississippi steamer that's about to depart. A 19-year-old girl, Alice Mitchell, forces her way through the crowd. Her eyes are fixed on the person she loves most in the world, her former lover. And she's wielding a cutthroat razor. This is the culmination of a passionate, stormy, and illicit relationship, riven with infidelity and jealousy from the very beginning.
I told you to think about what we were risking, but you said you would be mine. I am too jealous. I love you and would kill before I would see you taken from me.
Where are you going, Alice?
I'm going to see Fred one more time.
But this is no ordinary tale of star-crossed teenage love, because Alice's former lover and now victim, whom she calls Fred, is actually another girl. 17-year-old Frieda Ward. Alice's actions that day caused a nationwide sensation and will influence the way that lesbians are perceived by the press and by ordinary people for decades. I'm Lucy Worsley, and I'm back with the third series of Lady Killers. This time, I want to understand what made Alice Mitchell kill the woman she loved. And I want to find out what this case tells us about women's lives in the southern states of America at the end of the 19th century, and what it might tell us about women's lives today, particularly women in the LGBTQ plus community. To explore this case, I'm joined by not one, but two guests, Alexis Coe, historian, journalist, broadcaster, and author of the fabulous book, Alice and Frieda Forever, A Murder in Memphis, and Cameron Esposito, stand-up comic, actor, writer, and host of the hit podcast, Query. Welcome, both of you, to Lady Killers.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Alexis, let's start with you. Can you please tell us a bit more about Alice and Frieda? Who were they?
Alice and Frieda met at Miss Higby's School for Young Ladies, which was somewhere between a finishing school and the kind of school where if girls finished, they perhaps went to college to be teachers. The girls, like all girls in school, formed cliques, and Alice and Frieda found themselves a part of a quartet. It included Lily, who was Alice's best friend before Frieda moved to town, and Frieda's sister. But it was very clear from the beginning that there was something special between Alice and Frieda.
These two girls had been to this fancy school for nice young ladies. What were they supposed to do with their lives? What were the expectations of them?
The expectation for both of them was that they get married. So far, that was not going too well. Alice had no time for any of the suitors that her brother and father brought home. She wasn't interested.
So when Alice and Frieda were growing up in the late 19th century, let's think about this. Society broadly thought that female sex lives were all about reproduction, which meant that they had to be exclusively heterosexual. The historian Lisa J. Lindquist, amongst others, has written about the fact that it was only really in the 20th century that mainstream opinion could begin to conceive of two women having a relationship with a sexual component. Cameron, let's come to you. Alice and Frieda were living in a society that essentially denied their existence. In lots of places in the world, that is still the case. But what do you think that their lives might have been like?
Well, I don't have to actually imagine that. I'm 41, and I want to say that when I went to university, I went to a college where you could not come out. You could be kicked out of school for being gay. So that's like not from the distant past. That's from now. And I went to a conservative Catholic high school. And I will say what I relate to about this story is this is still what life is like. Mm,
you hear echoes of their experience, even within your own 41-year-old life.
Yeah, I relate.
Mm, that's really something to think about. Now, Alexis, the intensity of Alice and Frieda's friendship, their relationship, it was sort of hiding in plain sight, wasn't it?
They performed, as far as Memphians were concerned, the act of chumming, which was a performance for the great drama of their life, as Longfellow, the American poet, called it. They would pretend that they were engaged in a courtship. They would hold hands. They might even peck on the cheek. They would send each other love letters, and this was completely acceptable. It was considered practice, and girls among them were doing this. But for Alice, and I think for a time Frieda, this was not a exercise. This was the real thing. I think they absolutely loved each other, and we can read so much in the details of their letters that makes me confident that there was some kind of very real love between them.
A few months into this relationship, Frieda's family moves away from Memphis. They go to a town called Gold Dust, 70 miles north up the Mississippi River. Frieda comes back to Memphis to visit Alice for weeks at a time, and she sleeps in her bed. However, Frieda is keeping her options open, and she seems to enjoy toying with Alice's emotions. She tells Alice that she's in love with her, but she's also flirting with two men as well. One of them's called Ashley Rozelle. Meanwhile, Alice is totally devoted to Frieda alone. Many of the letters Alice and Frieda send each other are later published in newspapers, such as the Memphis Commercial. Listen to this one.
Dearest love, I am too jealous. I love you, Fred, and would kill Ashley before I would see him take you from me. You think I'm only saying that for fun, but I really mean it. If you would tell me the truth about it and wouldn't be so mean, I would not be so jealous. Please be true to me. I love you. I love you.
Alice and Frieda come up with a radical plan. Alice will live as a man, and they will marry, and they will move to St. Louis, about 300 miles to the north. Alice even thinks up a new name for herself. She's going to be Alvin J. Ward. In February 1891, Alice proposes to Frieda, and Frieda accepts. Alice even buys Frieda an engagement ring. It's engraved with the words from A to F. Let's hear from you, Cameron. What are your reflections on the story so far?
I would imagine that, like, for me anyway, I know I have a history. Like, I know I am not the beginning of queer life. And I hope it is okay with the ghosts of the past that I imagine that they were just like me. Because it helps me get through today.
Back to our story. Frieda is now living with her older married sister, Ada, up the river at Gold Dust, but Ada is getting suspicious. In August 1891, Frieda plans to run away to Memphis to be with Alice, but sister Ada foils this elopement. Ada now strictly forbids all contact between the two girls. She writes to Alice, warning her off. She also writes to Alice's mother, Isabella. But Isabella just can't believe that the two girls are considering running off together in the way that Ada suggests. And she thinks that Ada must have completely misunderstood the situation. After all, Alice and Frieda are just chums, aren't they? Under pressure from her sister, Frieda returns her engagement ring. And on the 1st of November, Alice steals her father's cutthroat razor. She carries it around with her in the pocket of her dress. In January 1892, though,
Alice begins to hope of a reconciliation because Frida comes back to Memphis. She and her sister Jo go to stay with another friend in the town. Alice now writes to Frida in Memphis, but her letter is returned unopened, and Frida blanks her in the street. Alice sends one last letter. This time she does get a reply from Frida, but it's devastating. Frida is breaking it off forever.
Dear Allie, I love you now and always will, but I've been forbidden to speak to you, and I have to obey. If I have done you any harm, I humbly beg your forgiveness. Please don't let anyone know I wrote this. We go back to Gold Dust this evening. Frida.
Alice puts Frida's letter into her pocket along with the razor. Frida and her sister don't actually return to Gold Dust that evening because bad weather delays the steamer. A few days later, on the 25th of January, Alice borrows her family's horse-drawn buggy. She picks up her friend Lily for a ride, but this isn't going to be a pleasant afternoon jaunt around town. Alice turns the horses towards the docks. She knows that the steamer's due to leave, and she's pretty sure that Frida will be on board. And there she is, with her sister Jo and another friend, picking her way across the icy quay towards the waterfront. Alice stops the horses at the post office, and she climbs down from the buggy.
Where are you going, Alice?
I'm going to see Fred one more time.
Alice catches up with Frida, and it looks like Alice is going to kiss her. But the next thing Frida's sister Jo sees is blood pouring from Frida's neck. Jo attempts to fight Alice off with an umbrella, but Alice slashes at her too. Frida tries to get away, but Alice is after her. There's one more flash of the razor as she falls to the ground. Alexis, do you think that Frida had an idea of what might be coming to her?
Frida had agreed to this outcome. They had exchanged many letters in which they had agreed that in the tradition of Romeo and Juliet that they would die together. And in Alice's mind, the reason she had been carrying around this razor was to keep that promise for them both, because she understood that Frida was no longer capable for whatever reason. She still believed that Frida loved her and was committed to this plan.
Oh, Cameron, this is such a shocking act. And when we think about reclaiming queer history, it's very tempting, isn't it, to only want to reclaim the positive stories, but we can't escape the fact that this is a really violent crime. Ugh, I almost feel bad that we're even telling it. It's a difficult one to tell and to hear, isn't it, Cameron?
We should totally be telling this story. And that is because we are complex individuals. We have every type of person in the queer community. We even have the bad ones. We sure do. And I also want to add that we should also make sure that folks don't come away from this story thinking that we are somehow more brutal than others. So yes, tell this story, but just make sure that we also put it in this larger context where we are not safe walking down the street.
Mm. I'll tell you why I feel a bit bad about telling this story, although it's a true story from history. It seems to me that lesbians are pretty invisible in popular culture, except when they're being murdered or murdering someone. You know, it's sometimes called the dead lesbian trope or bury your gaze. Is this something you've come across where the lesbian character is so often the one who is either doing the murdering or getting murdered?
Right. I mean, bury your gaze, which is, it's a trope in television and film where, you know, the moment that two queer folks find each other and kiss, there's often an errant bullet flies through the window that nobody knew to expect. And that is when the love story is over. And so when straight folks imagine our stories, I think the idea that we could ever have a life after that kiss, I think that's really the limitation there. We don't talk about raising kids, having homes. We don't talk about the mundane.
I guess we want lesbians to just live really boring lives, right?
That's what I'm trying to do. It's hard, though, as a stand-up comic. My life is unfortunately interesting.
I see where you're coming from with that. Can I get your views on this? After the overturning of Roe versus Wade in the Supreme Court, quite recently. Many fear that LGBTQ plus rights will be targeted next. As a member of that community, can you tell us a bit about what's happening now today in the US?
So what's happening today in the US is a backswing, a backslide. You know, the LGBTQ rights movement is the fastest progressing civil rights movement in US history. And so much was achieved, a lot of it in marriage and protections around hiring and firing and housing and who can use what bathrooms. But now it is being tested and chipped away. So I think about, for instance, age restrictions being put on drag performance and restrictions being placed on where drag can happen. So it can't happen in a public park or a library. It has to happen behind closed doors in a bar for folks who are, you know, 21 plus. And to me, that just echoes so much of what I heard, you know, when we were moving toward marriage equality. There was this constant refrain, you know, folks shouldn't be able to be out and be teachers because we have to separate kids from folks who are comfortable with their sexuality. And I hear that again in this movement to restrict drag performance. It's this idea that we're predators and that we're coming for your kids. And I just want to say that there are little queer kids. I was one of those kids. I could have used positive role models. And also there are kids who are not queer who are going to grow up in a world where these folks already exist. It's really just we exist. And I think kids should have access to that information. It is not damaging. It is helpful. It is reality.
Someone whose life has been turned upside down by these new restrictions is the Memphis drag artist, educator and activist, Marvelous Magical Miss Moffy. They bravely defied the new laws restricting drag in Tennessee to take a leading role in Memphis Pride 2023 and captured for us the atmosphere as the LGBTQ plus community came together in celebration and defiance.
We're here at Memphis Pride, a.k.a. Mid-South Pride, and it is beautiful. It is a cavalcade of energy and people. There's the shows starting and kicking off in the background, so we're ready to have fun, and I'm going to go and find some people to talk to.
Hi, welcome to Memphis Drag.
Now, Francis and Sarah, tell me a little bit about what Pride means to you. You know, I think that we're all looking for safe space in each other's hearts, our imaginations, and safe space in public places like this. You know, all the laws that have been swirling around us have damaged, especially in Tennessee and the southern states. It's damaged our ability to be out and about and be ourselves in open air. And that's so sad. I'm here with my new friend, Tyler. So, are born and raised in Memphis.
I grew up just having fun.
And we have so many good things to offer, like our drag queens, just
in our future.
Then our future is great. Like, times may be crazy, but we're not stop fighting. It's time that people realize that we're just people. And it doesn't matter who love and love is love.
Always.
Baby, I love you. I love you. Yeah, I didn't have to hand you not one note.
After Pride, Moff gave us some further, very moving thoughts about their situation.
Currently, I am the reigning Miss Mid-South Pride, and I was very happy to be awarded that. But you know, only about 3 weeks later after winning that is when I was arrested by the Memphis Police Department protesting the governor. You know, it's just like conservatives just suddenly hit some type of reality reset button, and then suddenly they don't have to play by the rules anymore of treating people fairly. They can just eliminate our rights and our abilities and our existences left and right. And that's not right. And I find it very hard. Everybody around me is finding it so hard to survive right now. And a state and a place where I love, this is where I was born, you know? But I feel constantly under threat of violence. You know, it makes my heart sick all the time. It makes me angry and hurt. And across many states in the United States and other countries, beware, because, you know, what's happening here will be copied and pasted in other places. Happens all the time. And it's just so sad that we can have so much history, so much progress. We can do so well. We can be at such a bright spot and then suddenly have the rug pulled out from underneath us and be left with literally nothing.
That is pretty powerful stuff. to listen to, isn't it? Cameron, how do you relate to what's being said there at Memphis Pride?
I mean, my heart is crushed. I'm very aware that this is how queer folks feel, because I feel this way often myself, walking on the street or, say, getting on an airplane somewhere where I'm just going to be encountering folks that that may or may not have space for me in the world. So these things mean that I have to speak out.
Let's find out what happens to Alice Mitchell after committing her crime. Within the hour, she is arrested at her family home. Frida's bloodstained letter is still in her pocket, and she makes a heartbreaking confession.
The day of our wedding was set, and I would have devoted my whole life to making Frida happy. But when Frida returned my engagement ring, it broke my heart. I could not bear the idea of being separated from her, whom I loved more dearly than my life. Then indeed I resolved to kill Frida, because I loved her so much that I wanted her to die loving me. And when she did die, I know she loved me better than any other human being on earth. Now I know she is happy.
Alice's father, George Mitchell, now takes control of events. He decides that Alice must be insane. It's the only possible explanation for his daughter having wanted to marry another woman. George hires very expensive lawyers for his daughter, and Alice is going to need them when she appears in front of an all-male jury in the packed courtroom of Judge Julius Dubois. He is a proud misogynist and an early leader of the Ku Klux Klan. Alice pleads present insanity when she first appears in front of him on the 1st of February, 1892. Then she languishes in prison for nearly 6 months until her lunacy inquisition on the 18th of July. The question for the jury to consider is whether Alice's mental capacity is sufficient to make a rational defence to the charge of murder. Alice's defence lawyers bring in a whole team of doctors to testify that she is not of sound mind.
Alice was a nervous, excitable child. As she grew, she did not manifest interest in those childish amusements and toys that girls are fond of. She was fond of horses and rode bareback as a boy would. To the family, she seemed a regular tomboy. She disliked sewing and needlework. She was wholly without that fondness for boys that girls usually manifest.
She didn't like sewing. She was clearly insane.
When I saw the evidence, it was very clear to me that they were throwing things against the wall to see what stuck. One of my favorite jokes to say at readings for Alice and Frida, I ask people who are left-handed to raise their hand. And then, well, I say, well, you're insane, because that was given as evidence of her insanity, along with having asymmetrical features, which most of us who are not models have.
Insanity is the verdict that Alice's father is after. An asylum is the most convenient place to put a difficult woman like Alice has proven herself to be. By making Alice a victim of illness, rather than somebody who'd made a decision to murder the woman she loved and couldn't have, middle-class Memphis can breathe a sigh of relief as the all-important social order has been restored.
But underneath that, there's the emotional reality of the situation. On the way to the Western Hospital for the Insane, Alice is allowed to visit Frida's grave in Elmwood Cemetery. And there she breaks down and she cries. Alexis, if their plan to go away and get married had succeeded, if the murder hadn't happened, would it have been happily ever after, do you think? Do you think that was even possible?
No, they were plagued with issues of infidelity and jealousy from the very beginning. If they had managed to leave Memphis and actually make it to St. Louis, I'm quite certain that Frida would have run away with someone,
No happy endings for them.
There's no heroes in this story.
No, no. Cameron, what do you take away from the story of Alice and Frieda?
What strikes me is that this is really a story of domestic violence. And I think when it's between two women, we often gloss over the fact that that might even be possible. Again, partially because I think there's an undervaluing of agency for women. And I just want to mark that that is true. The idea that somebody would pursue somebody to the end of the world to kill them if they couldn't be together.
Alice dies in the asylum in 1898, 6 years after the murder. She's buried in Elmwood Cemetery, just a quarter of a mile away from Frieda. The lives of these two young women were cut horribly short at just 17 and 25. I'm pretty convinced that Alice wasn't insane in the way that they meant it at her trial. I do think that she was an unbalanced individual, but also that she was a woman more than a century ahead of her time. It would take another 123 years before two women in Tennessee could marry. And now, you know, many worry that that right could be taken away again. Alice saw no reason why she shouldn't live her life with the woman she loved. But the rest of society strongly disagreed. Alice's love for Frieda transgressed pretty much every boundary of acceptable middle-class female behaviour. Is there anything we can take away that's positive from this really sad story? Well, I think that there is. Alice dared to think differently. And in doing that, she reminded us that queer people have always existed and always will. If only Alice and Frieda could have had a happy ending. Well, a huge thank you to Alexis Coe, to Cameron Esposito, and to the magical Miss Mothy, and to all the people they talked to in Memphis. Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to the picturesque county of Surrey, near London, to meet Mary Ann Brough, a woman who does the unthinkable, after her husband threatens to take everything she has, including her children. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Jane Greenwood, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Bill Hope, and Laurel Lefko. Sound design is by Chris McLean. The series producer is Julia Hayball, and the executive producer is Kirsty Hunter. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4, and you can catch up on the whole series if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. If you want to know even more about how we bring these fascinating stories to life for this podcast, you can join Roz and I for an exclusive behind-the-scenes chat about what it takes to make Lady Killers. Go to bbc.co.uk and search for Lady Killers, where you can follow the links to the Open University.